Welcome to the Behavioral Health Business Perspectives Podcast. I'm Laura Lovett, editor of Behavioral Health Business, your go-to source for behavioral health, industry news, and insights. In this episode, I'm talking to Corbin Petro, the founder of value-based care substance use disorder provider Eleanor Health. Petro recently stepped down from her role as CEO of Eleanor Health, but is still an advisor and a board member at the company. I wanted to sit down with Petro to talk about the future of value-based care and behavioral health and what payers are looking for. I also wanted to talk to her about her transition from CEO and what's next for her. Hello, and thank you for coming on.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me, Laura.
Yeah, I thought we could start. If you could just tell me a little bit about your experience in the industry in the substance use disorder space.
Great. Well, I'll start, Laura, before that. So I've been in healthcare broadly my whole career. The main themes of that have been in designing unique payment models, figuring out different ways of delivering care, particularly for the most vulnerable and underserved, and then integrating across both of those technology and data. So early half of my career, I was in consulting, most recently at Bain & Company, largely serving hospital, payer, health services clients. And then I spent a little bit of time in the public sector. So I helped advise a U.S. senator on health reform, and I was chief operating officer of Medicaid in Massachusetts. It was really those experiences where I wanted to get into an operating role really around designing and implementing and executing on some of those payment models, particularly for vulnerable populations. So prior to Eleanor Health, I was the founding CEO of a payer-provider joint venture. So, payers and providers typically on opposite sides of the table, brought them together, really unique risk-sharing models that we invented as part of that. And then we spun out a population health business as part of that. And it was really in that work where I started to see some of the real root causes of some of the exacerbated physical and medical conditions that we often see, for example, poorly managed diabetes. I found that it was often, as we went into patients' homes as part of this model, it was depression, opioid use disorder, substance use disorder. And really, it was through that where I wanted to start to get to the root cause and start to serve those with substance use disorder, other mental health conditions in a value-based environment. So I founded Eleanor Health in 2019 alongside a venture studio. And really from there, we really wanted to change how care and payment systems work together for people with substance use disorder, because we know that those people and those populations are complex. They often have multiple comorbidities, and their needs are really just not being well served by the healthcare system. And so that's brought us to today, where Eleanor Health is in 7 states. We have about 35 clinics across those 7 states. We do have a multimodal model where we deliver care virtually in the community and in those clinics. And I think unique to our model is we really try to address the whole person. We address co-occurring mental health conditions. We provide medication, not just medications for addiction, but also medications for other mental health conditions. And we have a unique relationship with payers and health plans. So we often take risk on populations, so downside total cost of care risk, or we have a value-based construct that we work with payers on. And that's been a real journey over the past 5 years, is really shifting the reimbursement structures that have existed for so long in this space.
Yeah, and I definitely want to go back to those reimbursement structures, but I also wanted to touch on, recently I know you decided to step down from your role as CEO at Eleanor Health. Can you talk to me a little bit about that transition and what's next for you?
Yeah, so obviously still incredibly passionate about Eleanor and very, very much involved. So I moved onto the board from the CEO role at the end of August. And really it's to be able to continue to provide the vision, innovation that we know is so important to drive this model forward, but to really hand the reins to somebody to scale all the amazing work that we've done across the 7 states that we're in. So We just signed about 5 or 6 new value-based contracts over the summer, and really the organization is positioned well for scale. And so we're ready to put the organization into the hands of an operator to really scale the model.
Yeah. Now I do want to talk a little bit about value-based care and some of those innovative structures. There's a lot of buzz right now around value-based care. And I know you've been one of the pioneers in this space. What are some misconceptions about value-based care that you've heard in the industry?
So one of the things when founders and others approach me on helping them get into value-based care contracts is really when you sort of dig into it, it's what they really are looking for is higher reimbursement, which can be part of value-based care. But the way I think of value-based care is when you're delivering a care model, you have to think about, or in any type of intervention in healthcare, you have to think about who is extracting the value and what value are you creating. Sometimes it's directly for the patient, sometimes it's for, you know, a health system, sometimes it's for the payer or whoever's supporting the reimbursement. And most value-based models that I think are successful are figuring out and quantifying what that value is, and then sharing in the sort of reward of that value. And so what we see in substance use disorder and how we approach it at Elanor is we know that our model reduces the total cost of care of the patients who we serve. So we know because we see it in the data time and time again, consistently over tens of thousands of patients, that we reduce the spend, but it's largely on the physical health side. So for years, as you know, we've split the brain and the body in paying for healthcare. And so the behavioral health spend sort of sits on one side and the medical spend sits on another. And it's really archaic when you think about it, because the brain controls so much of what happens with the body and vice versa. And so there's really no way to separate those two. They're inextricably linked. And so being able to communicate that and quantify that with payers, you know, we've been able to share in some of those cost savings that we see on another, you know, typically on another ledger within the healthcare system. And so I think that's often a misnomer, particularly in behavioral health, where reimbursement has been low for so long. If you look at other spaces like oncology, you know, oncologists are paid a lot of money. And so most oncologists aren't interested in value-based care because they're already, you know, they don't want to adjust their economics. And so it's really trying to figure out how you find who's winning and who's being incentivized to do what, and whether that makes sense for the sort of quality and clinical outcomes that you're getting.
Yeah. Now, you know, I know you've been doing this for quite a while. What are some of the lessons learned, you know, over the last 5 years that you could give to other providers about implementing value-based care and working with payers?
Well, first, I do think it's hard to sort of have your feet in two canoes, I think is how they describe it. So I do think it's really hard to try to operationalize, you know, a fee-for-service model and a value-based model. And so with Elanor and with many of the companies that are really succeeding in value-based care, they're purpose-built for value-based care. So what that means for us is, you know, we don't try to make money and bill for things that we know don't drive positive outcomes. So in the substance use disorder space, that's really urine drug screens and utilization of higher levels of care are the two that I see most that don't always drive positive outcomes, but are often leaned on to reimburse. And so I think the first is just to lean in on, again, the value that you're creating as a provider, and don't sway from that, because the fee-for-service system that we have in America really does incentivize you to do things that may or may not drive quality outcomes. And so if you're trying to change the paradigm of reimbursement, you really have to pick that lane.
Now, there's been a lot of talk about value-based care and needing an integrated approach. So between physical and behavioral health, how does that work in substance use disorder care? And, you know, what are some of the challenges of that too?
So as I described earlier, the separation of the two, behavioral and physical healthcare is archaic, and it really makes no sense. So absolutely, I think there needs to be an integrated approach, and I think that can work in a number of different ways. When I think about holding on to risk or who should own risk in some of these models, I think about it not as should it always be primary care or should it always be a certain type of provider. I think that varies based on the condition set and the comorbidities and complexities of the people and the populations that you're serving. What we saw in our space with substance use disorder was that 90% of the patients who we were treating, this was a couple of years ago, we started to see this, 90% were not well connected with primary care. So there was no sort of quarterback, the traditional quarterback of care. And so we felt like it was incumbent upon us as we were building this relationship with our patients to address those other comorbidities. And that meant, we have nurses who can help manage chronic conditions. We connect people very successfully with primary care. And so I think this integration between physical and behavioral health is so important. I think it can be done through referral relationships. I think it can be done through contractual relationships, or it can be done through a fully integrated model, which we see emerging more and more today. So I think some of the challenges generally are, obviously I've talked a little bit about sort of the separation of the brain and the body. Also, there is a shortage of primary care providers. And so many, and I don't want to disparage primary care providers, but this is a complex population, those who have substance use disorder, and many don't feel that they're equipped to serve this patient population. And so, aren't raising their hands a lot of the time to serve this population. And so that's a challenge as well.
Yeah. And, when you're thinking about whole person care, are there any types of team members like peers or nurses or, maybe it's therapists who kind of needs to be in on those conversations when really addressing that whole person?
So this is interesting because it really varies on the person. Many people have, various internal stigmas around different types of providers. So we've run into people who don't at all want a therapist because there's a stigma around that. We have others who, sort of bristle at a peer because they don't feel like that person reflects the experiences that they've had. And so we have, and we believe in a, multidisciplinary team that includes therapists, that includes, doctors, nurses, peers, coaches. So coaches who do many of the same functions as a peer, but don't have the same type of life experience. And what we have what we see is that there are different, there are different types of relationships that develop, and we allow those to sort of mature organically. And then we allow the relationship that seems to be the primary one to sort of hold on to those care coordination and other aspects and really address some of those whole person needs. So I do think it's important in a lot of these models addressing the needs of people with substance use disorder to have mechanisms and people in place to address those social drivers, the community piece, therapy, other components, because every journey in recovery in particular is unique, and it's important to be able to address, at least for us, it's been important to address the needs of a lot of different people as opposed to having sort of a cookie cutter model or a cookie cutter care model for only one subtype of patient population.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Now, another big topic right now is measurement-based care. How does the industry ensure that measurement-based care gets implemented correctly? And how can providers help guide that conversation for payers?
So this is a fascinating topic because broader behavioral health, substance use disorder is really in the early stages of developing a core set of metrics that makes sense for this space. I know when we started Eleanor, it was all about sort of negative urine drug screens and retention. And when you think about those two measures, it really incentivizes providers to cherry pick patients who are the most compliant. It also encourages what I would call sort of stigmatized and harmful behavior to firing patients for non-compliance to certain measures and metrics. And so I think we're in the early days. We think of the measures and metrics in this space as much like we think about population health, where we're really looking to improve the population that we're serving. So, you know, if your starting point was an opioid use disorder, we look to, you know, reduce your cravings, improve your anxiety, improve your depression, improve your substance, reduce your substance use, as opposed to saying you're only successful if you completely stop using opioids. And so that would be my advice for the industry is trying to sort of benchmark and baseline individuals and populations and then improve those. But as an industry, we really do need to pick a set of metrics. You know, I had a conversation yesterday with somebody who, you know, was sort of over PHQ-9 and GAD-7, the two psychometrically validated scales and screeners that have reams and reams of data around anxiety and depression, because, you know, she felt that there were other surveys and assessments that did a better job. And, you know, I think you hear a lot of that. There are companies that are emerging that track and move companies toward measurement-based care, but those measures aren't always what payers are looking at. I think a good place to look now is, you know, what is HEDIS coming out with? So there are a number of HEDIS measures around, you know, initiation of treatment, follow-up after hospitalization, that allow us to really wrap our arms around people when they have an acute event. And I think those are really important measures and metrics to start trying to operationalize across the models that we have in this space. And then I think one that I hope we all can agree on is reducing ED and inpatient stays for people with behavioral health conditions and substance use disorder. So, you know, often it's the behavioral health and the substance use disorder that exacerbates physical health conditions, or it's those BH and SUD conditions that send somebody into the emergency room. And when you're really treating them well and wrapping them in a whole person care model, those events will go down. And that's good for payers, it's good for providers and hospital systems, and it's good for patients.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that population health approach. How can kind of taking that approach to care really help providers look at care in that more holistic way?
Well, looking at a population and even, you know, evaluating that population against a matched cohort, which is a sort of actuarial and statistical way of looking at populations and saying, okay, this population looked exactly like this other population. One population got an intervention, the other population didn't. How do they compare? That's one way to see what interventions are working. How are they changing the trajectory that some of these patient populations have? So that's the way to really understand how interventions are working across a population. I also think when you have a population-based approach where you are comparing it to, you know, a similar population, there's less incentive to cherry pick and to fire patients or to kick patients out for certain behaviors. And that will allow us to really treat those who have been most underserved in this space.
Yeah. Now, one of the other major disruptions in the substance use disorder space is the potential end of the DEA telehealth flexibilities. These changes were delayed until December 2024, but how can providers start to think about future-proofing themselves if these flexibilities are taken away? And what should the DEA know about patient care when implementing these changes?
So first, I'll just say that we, you know, at L&R, you know, we are fully supportive of the telehealth flexibilities, and we think that's really, you know, enabled an expansion of care. I certainly understand concerns about, you know, misuse of telehealth and other you know, opportunities for abuse that exist, but we're supportive of that. That said, you know, I mentioned we do have clinics, so for us, We also believe fundamentally in a hybrid approach. We believe that it meets the needs of more patient populations, which is our goal in Eleanor, is to meet the needs not just of a subset, but of anyone with a substance use disorder. And we have found as COVID has subsided that there is a strong interest in building those connections in person. But to get to your point on the end question on the limitations being extended, or the flexibility, sorry, being extended to December 2024, I think to future proof, many of the, there are obviously a new wave of virtual SUD providers, many of whom I know, love what they're trying to do, appreciate that we're all in this together trying to help people. With them, I know that, trying to identify and partner with whether it's primary care providers, public health departments, having their own, mobile vans. There are a lot of different tactics that have emerged to try to close those, close that need to have an in-person visit, which is the concern that I think many have, is that you cut off the virtual only approach and you automatically cut off or you hurt those who are in rural and underserved areas, those who are affected by stigma and aren't willing to or have a concern with coming in person. And so I think I think DEA they need to understand and see that people there will be people who are hurt on in reducing the flexibilities. There are people who have really embraced a care model that's virtual only because of their circumstances. And I think we need to be aware of that and do the right analysis to understand what's the best path forward.
Yeah, makes sense. I know Eleanor has that hybrid model. Are you finding that most patients are trying to access care through telehealth or through in-person? What does that breakdown look like?
So our breakdown has remained more virtual than in person. So obviously, prior to COVID, we were 10% virtual and 90% in person. That flipped very quickly, as we know, in March of 2020, to about 90% or more virtually, and the rest in person. The in person visits have increased, but it's still a majority of our visits at Eleanor are virtual. But I will say that almost all of the patients who we serve are looking for care in their community. And so they want to know that the care is being delivered right around the corner from them. They want to know that we're there. They want to know that they can come in if they need to come in. And so that local presence is really important to be part of the community for such a stigmatized condition. We know the pharmacies, we know the pharmacists, we know, the community organizations. I think that piece is really important, whether or not they ultimately come in person or not. Being part of that community is really important.
Yeah. Now, you've been working with Medicaid populations for a very long time. Are there any legislative trends that you're looking at that would relate to either Medicaid or substance use disorder in particular that you're really watching that could change the future in the next few years?
Well, I think reimbursement is really important in this space. I'm advising and talking to a lot of companies in the behavioral health space, and fee for service just doesn't work in this space. It's really hard to drive quality and outcomes in an outpatient behavioral health model. And so, I know that states are exploring more value-based models. We see it in a number of different states. They've already expanded in most states to cover peer and other services that, as we talked about earlier, are the evidence shows is very it's successful in helping to drive positive outcomes for this population. I track CMMI pretty closely, which is the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation. They come out with payment model innovations, and that they've hinted that they're going to be launching and putting out a behavioral health and a substance use disorder model this year. So I'm excited to see what happens there, because often it's the models that come out of that group and CMS that are often then adopted by state Medicaid departments. So You know, I think those are the types of areas that I track to. I will say that over the past, you know, 4 and 5 years where we've been launching Eleanor, I would say over the past year or two, the move and the ability to administer case rates and bundled payment models by payers in both the Medicaid and commercial space has gone up dramatically. So early in our in early Eleanor days, you know, 2019, 2020, there were very, very few payers who could administer a bundled payment model. And so just the fact that there are more that are able to do that, I think is a good sign for mental health and for, you know, expanding the reach of a lot of these models.
Yeah, definitely. It's something we'll be closely watching too. Now, last week we were both at Invest. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about investment trends and, you know, are investors ready to invest in value-based care for behavioral health?
So I think, you know, you guys did a great job. So congrats on that conference. I had a lot of great conversations. I learned a lot, which is always fun. So I think, you know, what I hear from investors and a lot of the folks there were sort of middle market or larger private equity. Most of the models, including Eleanor, are subscale. And so it is hard to invest in those. I think we'll see consolidation in the space because, you know, everyone's seeking to get some type of scale in the market. And there aren't many scaled players that are out there. I had a number of conversations where that was the theme of the conversation was just the fact that most companies who have entered into the space aren't at scale. And so I think we'll see that over the next year or two is some M&A activity to really support the best in class models in getting to scale. In terms of value-based care, you know, if we've been talking about value-based care, I mean, I was part of the Affordable Care Act. I advised a senator in putting forth a lot of value-based policies in the Affordable Care Act. And that was almost 15 years ago at this point. And, you know, I think we are starting to see movement in the direction of value-based care. I think payers are looking more and more at, you know, risk-bearing models. They're looking at quality providers. I think to the extent that we can track and measure what quality and what outcomes we want to see, I think we'll be more successful in pushing those value-based models, because it really is, you know, the reimbursement is an important part of these innovative care models. So I think that's coming faster than we think in the behavioral health space. And so I hear that from investors as well, that they're excited about that movement and what that means for areas that they can invest in.
Yeah, definitely something we'll be watching. Is there anything else that I haven't asked yet that you'd like to highlight, either in SUD care or value-based care?
No, I think we covered a lot. I mean, I appreciate you guys do a great job of really being on the front lines and leading edge in a lot of these discussions. I learned a lot again at the conference last week around some of the other areas of healthcare crisis care, IDD, that are often overlooked. So I really, really enjoyed that. And my hope is that, you know, value-based care and a value-aligned models permeate those spaces as well.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. And it was so great to have you on. I feel like I learned a lot from this conversation and can't wait to touch base to see what happens next year in value-based care and SUD. Thank you so much.
Great. Thanks for having me.
That does it for this episode for Behavioral Health Business Perspective Podcast. I'm Laura Levitt with Aging Media, a WTWH media company. Thank you for listening.